Good evening, everyone. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the Society Library. This is our second-to-last event for this June season. We will be back in September with many more events, but I'm sad to say this is our second-to-last event. I thank you all for coming out on a very nice evening that probably some people are sneaking away and getting into Central Park and going for a walk, but I'm glad you're here for Mr. Reynolds' presentation. This is both a talk and a book signing. Our friends from the Corner Bookstore are here outside in the Peluso Gallery, and they're happy to sell you a copy of the hardback or the paperback, which I believe is actually in the stores next Tuesday. So tonight you can actually get the paperback a little early. The book was published in 2011, Mightier Than the Sword, Uncle Tom's Cabin and the Battle for America, and it was published that year to celebrate the 200th anniversary of Harriet Beecher Stowe's birth, and as I said, is coming out in paperback shortly. Before we begin, if you do have a cell phone or a pager, if you don't mind just taking it out and turning it off, that would be wonderful, both for the folks here and for our event recording. We do record our events here at the Society Library, and we put them up on YouTube for the benefit of others. This is the time of the year when I do need to thank our friends here in the library for your support of the Spring Appeal, which this year has garnered a nice tidy sum to support our general library operations, and this year the children's library. And believe me when I say that it is really important to have your support to continue great programs like the one tonight and our reading groups that have been wildly popular this spring, this term, our groups on Milton, Edith Wharton, Trollope, and our crime fiction series as well. And, of course, our book collection, which grows. As you can see tonight, I actually brought out books related to our event this evening, and it gave me pause to think that the library, having been around for 258 years, we were one of the original libraries in the city collecting Harriet Beecher Stowe as the books were being published, and we have many fine early editions. Tonight, our speaker, Dr. Reynolds, will provide us some thoughts on one of the world's most important works of fiction, Uncle Tom's Cabin, originally published back in 1852. He will explain the importance of Stowe's work in the making of America. He holds a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, and is a distinguished professor of English and American Studies at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. He's the author of many fine volumes, including Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson, John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Sparked the Civil War, Killed Slavery, and Ceded Civil Rights, and Walt Whitman's America, which won the Bancroft Prize. He is certainly one of the country's leading literary critics, biographers, and historians, and it's a real pleasure to have him with us tonight. One thing I was reflecting on today was that Dr. Reynolds has recently been in Salem at the Salem Athenaeum, one of our sister libraries in the membership library circle. And in late 2011, he spoke at the Library Company of Philadelphia, which was founded in 1731 by Benjamin Franklin and is the mother of the subscription libraries or membership libraries. And he gave the keynote lecture at an event there. So let me sit down and let the man who you're here to hear speak come to the podium. Please welcome David S. Reynolds.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's just great to be at New York Society Library. I'm here to talk about Harriet Beecher Stowe's massively best-selling novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is perhaps the most influential novel ever written by an American, and it yielded the most popular and longest-running play in American history. The novel appeared in 1852, 9 years before the outbreak of the Civil War, and it created such a stir with its powerful anti-slavery message that Lincoln reportedly called Stowe the little lady who made this great war. We don't know for sure if he said that. She did meet him in November 1862, to try to persuade him to sign the Emancipation Proclamation, which he was going to do anyway. But although a lot of people were worried. So she went to the White House. And back then, you could actually make an appointment to see the president, particularly if you were Harry Beecher Stowe. And supposedly that's how he greeted her. It kind of sounds like him anyway, although there's no absolute proof of it. At any rate, many, many people were saying similar things. And as a matter of fact, the very day that the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, January 1st, 1863, she was at a theater, and the theater just erupted with applause. And there were three cheers for Lincoln, three cheers for William Lloyd Garrison, and three cheers for Harriet Beecher Stowe. And she came to the balcony, and her bonnet toppled off, and tears were streaming down her face because the crowd realized how much she had done. So it's a great time to think about this wonderful novel. And it appeared exactly 160 years ago this March in book form. Previously, it had been running in installments for about a year in a Washington newspaper, but then it came out in March 1852. And it was exactly 150 years ago this year. That was the first full year of the Civil War, so it's really a great time to think about the confluence of both these anniversaries of the Civil War and of Harriet Beecher Stowe, and as Mark mentioned, 200 years ago, last June she was born, so all these kind of sesquicentennials and bicentennials are coming together. How could this little lady create such an uproar? She was a diminutive woman, just 5 feet tall, dreamy-eyed, a busy housewife with 6 children. She suffered from a number of real or imagined illnesses, though she lived to the age of 85. Around the time that she wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, she described herself in a letter, "I'm a little bit of a woman, somewhat more than 40, about as thin and dry as a pinch of snuff. Never very much to look at in my best days." I think she was a little too self-critical. I think she had a quite striking look to her. "And looking like a used-up article now," she said. She lived, she really was an incredibly modest person. She lived in a day when women had no political voice. They couldn't vote. That didn't come till 1920. And they were supposed to stay out of political discussions. If they lectured publicly, they were considered laughable at best, dangerous at worst. One father of the time wrote in a newspaper article that he would rather see his beloved daughter dead rather than see her speak in public. After Stowe became famous, she took a grand tour of Europe in 1853, where crowds cheered her everywhere. But following the custom of the day, she didn't speak. She just sat and smiled and waited while her husband or her brother got up and talked. Women's professional options were limited, and those who tried their hand at writing, as Stowe did, were faced with daunting challenges. After all, this was the era that had produced some of our greatest male writers: Emerson, Melville, Hawthorne, Poe, Walt Whitman, just to name a few. There were a number of popular women writers, but when you think about some of these great works of, Moby Dick, Scarlet Letter, The Raven, Leaves of Grass, all of them appeared within 8 years of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And yet, Uncle Tom's Cabin had a far greater influence on society and politics than any of these works did. Stowe had an explanation for the effect of her novel. When, after Uncle Tom's Cabin had become such a hit, she heard a relative was worried she'd become vain about this, she just laughed and said he didn't have to worry about that because she didn't write Uncle Tom's Cabin. This comment provoked the amazed question, "What? You didn't write that book?" She said, "No, God wrote it. It all came before me in a series of visions." And so she attributed the novel to divine inspiration. But what were the real-life sources of the book? How did it become so influential? These are the kinds of questions I take up in my book, Mightier Than the Sword, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and the Battle for America. Let's see. When we look at her early life, we recognize that many personal and cultural streams contributed to this earth-shaking novel. She had deep family roots that reach back to early New England, which may explain why I feel I can identify with her a little bit, because that's where my roots are as well. Her father was a leading Protestant clergyman, actually the leading clergyman of his day in New England, and really the first one to extensively link Christianity with social reform. He had started out in East Hampton, Long Island, where he spent a decade preaching among Native Americans mainly, before moving to Litchfield, Connecticut, where Harriet was born on June 14, 1811. Lyman Beecher was the head of the so-called Benevolent Empire, a nationwide system of reform networks aimed at changing America for the better. Among his 13 children, by two wives, his first wife passed away, and then he had four additional children with a second wife. Among them was Henry Ward Beecher, who became the most popular Protestant minister of 19th century America, and carried on the reform tradition, although he was actually more anti-slavery than Lyman Beecher was more a little more conservative on the slavery issue. Also, Catherine Beecher, the pioneer of education reform for women. Isabella Beecher Hooker, the suffragist. And, of course, most famous of all, Harriet Beecher Stowe. When Harriet was in her 20s, she moved with her family to Cincinnati, Ohio, where her father became president of Lane Theological Seminary. Ohio was a border state where fugitive slaves were constantly coming over from Kentucky to seek freedom in the North. She was married to the theology professor Calvin Stowe, who shared her sympathy for fugitive slaves. Together, they became involved in the Underground Railroad, and once they helped send a fugitive slave woman to Canada with the help of friendly Northerners who became characters in Uncle Tom's Cabin. Calvin, her husband, was a brilliant man. He knew six languages, was considered really about the leading biblical scholar in the nation at that time. On the other hand, he had a meager professor's salary that, because of the misfortunes of Lane Theological Seminary, kept sinking. So at one point he was making $200 a year, which even then the average worker would make maybe $480 a year, and a skilled worker would make about $800 a year. So even back then that wasn't really very much money. And so he encouraged Harriet to write magazine stories and articles that brought in extra money, $35 here, $40 there, and pretty good money in those days. And it helped support their growing family. And all these writings appear long before Uncle Tom's Cabin, between 1833 and 1851, and then Uncle Tom's Cabin comes out in 1852. And if we look back in these earlier writings, we see the kind of rich compost or soil from which Uncle Tom's Cabin came. Three of the early tales attack slavery. Besides writing against slavery, she witnessed it once when she and a friend traveled to nearby Kentucky across the river and visited a plantation. This was her only direct exposure to slavery, but it made a lasting impression and provided several scenes for Uncle Tom's Cabin. Her friend said that she just sat there quietly and kind of looked around her and sort of absorbed these scenes that kind of she recognized later in the novel. But the novel wouldn't have had such a huge impact if it didn't have other elements that made it appealing to the public. And if we actually go back to those early stories and read them, we see all these elements, these tributaries that kind of flow into what became the river, the mighty river of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And the popular writings of the day can be roughly divided between two types, the sensational and the sentimental. Sensational writings, usually published as pamphlet novels, were adventurous, exciting works that featured criminals, pirates, or other social outcasts involved in nefarious deeds that were often bloody or transgressive. Stowe wrote about this popular literature in her articles and letters. She thought it was immensely popular. She criticized it because it struck her as immoral, and yet she was fascinated by it. And she confessed in a letter that she couldn't put down some of these racy books. She was also aware of the contrasting kind of popular literature, the sentimental, which was didactic and religious. Among her own early tales were stories about people who had visions of angels in heaven, and she and her husband took comfort in their own visions of spiritual beings, visions that were not at all unusual in that century of spirit wrappings, seances, and conversations with the dead. Seances were even held in the Lincoln White House, and William James, the most brilliant man of the century, would start a society for study of psychic phenomena and so forth. So it wasn't really that unusual. Her early tales about angels directly anticipate Uncle Tom's Cabin, in which the blonde little Eva and the enslaved Uncle Tom have comforting visions of the other world. Another kind of fiction she wrote were temperance tales, which emphasized the virtues of sobriety and the savagery and crime that they believed came from drinking. In Uncle Tom's Cabin, the virtuous characters, mainly Northerners who help out fugitive slaves, are clean living types whose strongest drink is tea. The pro-slavery characters in the novel, in contrast, guzzle alcohol and are violent, despicable people, particularly the slave owner, what's his name? Simon Legree, who's vicious. Not everybody remembers that name, but if you've read the novel, you do. Simon Legree, whose vicious treatment of Tom and other slaves is fueled by his heavy drinking. So she was kind of writing all this temperance stuff and about, you know, angels and so forth. She also wrote about sinless children. She had kind of a romantic Wordsworthian view and Bronson Alcott view of the child. And she accepted this view of children as innocent souls who were living examples of Christian love and also of a kind of democracy, of reaching across the religious divide and the racial divide as well. And the stories that she wrote on this topic led to the iconic character in Uncle Tom's Cabin, the dying Eva St. Clair, who sympathizes with slaves and who looks forward to a joyful afterlife. Stowe's other tales included ones in which she recreated Bible scenes in a deeply human way, and this personal engagement with the Bible lay behind the original vision that she said produced Uncle Tom's Cabin. She had come east in 1850 to Brunswick, Maine, because her husband had accepted a new job at Bowdoin College. And as she told the story, she was at a communion service in a Brunswick church, and as she was thinking about Christ on the cross, she had a vision of an enslaved man being whipped to death under the direction of a white slave owner. And so she went home, and with this vision in her mind, she says, she wrote down the scene, which became the tragic climax of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And then other scenes rushed into her mind. She started writing chapters that were published in installments, as I mentioned earlier, in the anti-slavery newspaper, The National Era. She became the first writer in American history to successfully combine the adventure, thrills, and blood of sensational fiction. Finally, she produced a kind of sensational fiction. There are a lot of sensational scenes here, including the bloody whipping of Uncle Tom and so forth. Combining that with images of angels, of heaven, of temperance, and the sinless child, and kind of fusing the sensational and the sentimental in such a way that they swayed the emotions of millions of readers. And in the main, also made a crystal clear social point: slavery and the institutions behind it were evil. She aimed her novel directly at the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which imposed penalties on Northerners who helped runaway blacks. This pro-slavery law confirmed the clause of the Constitution that mandated the return of any person held to labor or service in one state who escapes into another must be returned. So in a sense, the Constitution at that time was viewed as a pro-slavery document. This was before the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, of course, before the Civil War. So Harriet Beecher Stowe was the leading popularizer of what was called the higher law, held by those who looked beyond the Constitution as it then stood, or the Fugitive Slave Act, to the law of natural justice supported, they believed, Harriet Beecher Stowe believed, by God and morality, which its advocates believed was higher than any human law. The ex-slave Frederick Douglass wrote of Uncle Tom's Cabin, "We doubt if abler arguments have ever been presented in favor of the higher law than may be found here in Mrs. Stowe's truly great work." And Stowe had personal connections to advocates of the higher law. Before her novel had appeared, she had a long friendship with William H. Seward, the anti-slavery New York senator, who in a famous speech before Congress had declared that in considering slavery, Americans must follow a higher law than the Constitution. Seward was really the one who popularized the phrase the higher law. In the 1840s, before he even said that, he had served as a lawyer in a national legal case that originated in Ohio and involved Stowe's friend John Van Zandt, the model for John Van Trump, a character in Uncle Tom's Cabin who helps fugitive slaves. Van Zandt was a farmer and a conductor on the Underground Railroad. In the spring of 1843, right in the neighborhood where Harriet and Calvin Stowe lived near Cincinnati, Van Zandt encountered a family of 9 runaway slaves, put them in his farm wagon, with the aim of starting the North on the Underground Railroad, but he was arrested for violating a previous fugitive slave law of 1793. And his case was, he was arrested, taken to court, and his case went all the way to the Supreme Court, where he was defended by Seward and by another close friend of Harriet Beecher Stowe, Salmon Chase. Later, of course, Seward was Lincoln's Secretary of State, and Chase became his Secretary of the Treasury. At any rate, in their argument before the Supreme Court, Chase and Seward turned the Van Zandt case into a lesson on the higher law. No legislature, Chase told the Supreme Court about slavery, can make right wrong or wrong right. No legislature can make men things or things men. And it's telling, I believe, that Stowe's original subtitle for Uncle Tom's Cabin was the ironic phrase, the man that was a thing. She was very much aware of this case, and she kind of had that on her mind when she wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. And Chase also said, on questions which partake largely of a moral nature, the judgment even of this Supreme Court cannot be regarded as altogether final. This certainly would prove true with the Dred Scott decision and a few other decisions along the way. At any rate, the decision to be made here must necessarily be rejudged at the tribunal of public opinion, the opinion not just of the American people, but of the entire civilized world. Chase's appeal to the higher law failed to persuade the Supreme Court. Van Zandt lost the case, and he died a brokenhearted man, and he was fined $1,700, which was back then was just an impossible amount of money. However, the case was not completely lost because Van Zandt and Chase had a determined friend in Harriet Beecher Stowe who put all fugitive slave laws on trial before the tribunal of the entire world in Uncle Tom's Cabin, which became, as Seward declares, Van Zandt's greatest monument. Well, it was Van Zandt's greatest monument and also the monument to many other people, white and black, that I discuss at some length in Muddier Than the Sword. And Stowe incorporated their personal stories in there and produced this incredible work, Uncle Tom's Cabin. And she expertly wove together these real-life stories with all those elements of popular culture that I discussed earlier. And it rang so many bells for readers that it just sold like wildfire. Her novel featured two compelling plots, the northern plot, in which the fugitive slave Eliza Harris makes a daring escape with her baby in arms across the breaking ice of the Ohio River to the north, where she reunites with her slave husband, George Harris, and both of them finally make it up their way with the Underground Railroad to Canada. This is based on a real-life Eliza Harris, who actually did escape across the ice, and Harriet Beecher Stowe had learned this from an Ohio friend of her, John Rankin, who helped out Eliza Harris. But anyway, then there's the Southern plot, in which the kindly Uncle Tom is tragically sold away from his wife and three children and ends up in the deep South under the command of the cruel master, Simon Legree, who orders the fatal whipping of Uncle Tom, who would rather die than tell Legree where two enslaved black women are hiding. The excitement over Uncle Tom's Cabin grew when it appeared in monthly installments, and then when it finally came out in book form in 1852, it shattered sales records and created an international sensation. The Boston preacher Theodore Parker declared, "It has excited more attention than any book since the invention of printing." This is the frontispiece of the first edition. In the first year, it sold over 310,000 copies in America and nearly 2 million copies abroad, which would be very, very good sales nowadays. I mean, in any day, that would be a wonderful, wonderful sale. And the novel had far more readers than it did purchasers. Because often Uncle Tom's Cabin, in a day before TV and internet and all that, Uncle Tom's Cabin was the family entertainment, It was read aloud to the whole family, and this was a time when the average family had 7 to 9 children. It was estimated that 10 people read the novel or heard the book read aloud for every purchaser of the book. So really, there was kind of an exponential sort of thing at work here. For the first time, Northerners felt the horrors of slavery on the nerve endings. Many anti-slavery reformers jumped on the Uncle Tom juggernaut. Previously, the anti-slavery movement had been divided into small, sometimes conflicting groups that were widely unpopular. Uncle Tom's Cabin was a force for unity among these sometimes fragmented anti-slavery groups. The radical abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, who had been hauled through the streets of Boston on a rope because he was so unpopular, He cried when he read the novel, which he wrote would be, quote, eminently serviceable to the anti-slavery battle. Equally receptive to the novel were anti-slavery groups who were hostile to Garrison, such as the evangelical Tappanites. Stowe was overjoyed by the embrace of her novel by the different anti-slavery factions, and she wrote, the fact that the wildest and extremist abolitionists, she's thinking of Garrison, have united with the coldest conservative anti-slavery people to welcome and advance my book is a thing I've never ceased to wonder at. And she was saying that not really bragging. She really wasn't. She was just really amazed that had happened. Her novel helped create a more positive view of black people in society at that time. Most whites in that era saw blacks as subhuman or comically irresponsible, as seen as these images from minstrel shows, popular humor, and ethnographic science of the era. These pictures more or less speak for themselves, but they also speak for the era in which produced them. Harriet Beecher Stowe in Uncle Tom's Cabin challenged such attitudes. In scene after scene, she showed the humanity of enslaved people. She made marital fidelity between enslaved blacks the driving force of her novel's two plots, The Escape to Canada, the slave couple Eliza and George Harris, and the tragic separation of the enslaved Uncle Tom from his family. The impact of the novel was amplified by a powerful cultural phenomenon known as Tomitudes, representations of the novel in all popular mediums, puzzles, card games, dolls, chinaware, and so forth. This phenomenon spread abroad. In London, you could buy Uncle Tom's Cabin shrinkable woolen stockings and Uncle Tom's Cabin pure unadulterated coffee. In Paris, restaurants offered menu items named after Uncle Tom characters. These are just a few examples of Tomitudes. And what distinguishes many of them from today's spin-off merchandise, Spider-Man t-shirts or Superman lunchboxes or whatever, Star Wars plastic toys and the like, is that many of the Tomitudes had a distinctly political message. In most of this merchandise, blacks were not presented as caricatures or stereotypes, and a number of Uncle Tom's games, like the novel, invited players to sympathize with slaves, such as a very popular card game whose goal was the reunion of slave families that had been disunited, had been separated. Here are a few more examples. This is a very popular doll. There's a little caricature going on there, but now the most influential Tomitudes tie-ins were plays based on the novel, the first of which appeared in 1852, just a few months after the publication of the novel. Far more people saw the play than read the novel. Pathos, thrills, music, impressive backdrops, all the crowd-pleasing elements were there in the play, which appeared throughout the North and everywhere made converts to the anti-slavery cause. The most surprising converts were Northern working-class types who had previously been known for their violence against abolitionists, and sometimes, yes, against African Americans. It was unprecedented to see white working class people cheering for fugitive slaves, hissing at a cruel slave owner, and weeping over the death of an enslaved man. Night after night, working class audiences applauded scenes that had a strong anti-slavery message. The novel had a role in the political reshuffling that lay behind the rise of the anti-slavery Republican Party. Back then, the Republican Party was really the liberal party. The Democrats were increasingly conservative and pro-slavery, and Republicans were based on anti-slavery. Anyway, Stowe was often mentioned in political speeches, like one on the House floor by her friend, the Ohio Congressman Joshua Giddings, who said, "A lady with her pen has done more for the cause of freedom during the last year than any savant, statesman, or politician in the land. That inimitable work, Uncle Tom's Cabin, is now carrying truth to the minds of millions who up to this time have been deaf to the cries of the downtrodden." The novel changed many people's votes by melting their hearts. It was part of the explanation behind the success of two unlikely anti-slavery Republican candidates, John Fremont, who ran strongly in 1856, and Lincoln, who won in 1860. The one place that the Uncle Tom's epidemic was resisted was in the American South. Here's a Southern political cartoon showing the hellish chaos that the South believed would result if the anti-slavery principles behind Stowe's novel were put into effect in America. And it's kind of hard to see, but Stowe's here by a cave leading to the depths of hell. The cave is called the Underground Railroad, and she's holding a book called Uncle Tom's Cabin, I Love Black People, which is, you know, anyway, there are a lot of sort of bad racial jokes going on here. And anyway, you could go through, on the right-hand side, she's being pulled by a bunch of devils, and that's her carriage in England where she was feted and everything, and all kinds of kind of symbols going on there. But it's a Southern cartoon, and many Southern states criminalized the sale of the novel. One man in the South was sentenced to jail for 10 years just for having the novel in his home. He escaped from jail after 5 years, and he went to Harriet Beecher Stowe's house, and he was an African-American, and she helped him. She was living in Hartford at the time. Now, it also generated down south a very strong, huge new body of pro-slavery literature. Previously, very long defenses of slavery were thought to be unnecessary. After all, Washington and Jefferson had owned slaves, and so had most other presidents and politicians and Supreme Court justices, so it seemed a natural part of the American system. But Uncle Tom's Cabin impelled many Southern writers to promote slavery at great length. Almost 30 pro-slavery novels were written as direct replies to Uncle Tom's Cabin. These novels presented slavery as a wonderful institution that gave shelter, food, and religious instruction to people brought from Africa. But Harriet Beecher Stowe optimistically hoped that people would be melted by her novels so they'd have a tremendous change of heart and recognize how evil slavery was. She also helped organize anti-slavery rallies and distribute petitions. She was ecstatic over the rise of Lincoln and the Republicans, but she was increasingly uncertain that either politics or persuasion were going to do away with slavery. The Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opened up the Western territories for slavery, darkened her view, and her next anti-slavery novel called Dred, which anticipated the name of the Dred Scott decision, which stripped black people of any rights. Anyway, Dred was gloomier than Uncle Tom's Cabin. Its hero is a militant fugitive slave who hides out in southern swamps and predicts a violent judgment day for slaveholders. The novel shows that Stowe, the creator of the gentle Uncle Tom, was now thinking of violence as a possible solution to the slavery problem. And for this reason, she came to revere the anti-slavery warrior, John Brown, who killed pro-slavery settlers in Kansas and then led a bold raid on Harper's Ferry, Virginia, in a heroic but doomed effort to liberate slaves there, after which he was captured, imprisoned, and hanged in 1859. Stowe's esteem for Brown matched that of two other former pacifists, Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson, who, believing that now, unfortunately, only bloodshed would end slavery, swayed Northern opinion by comparing Brown to the leaders of the American Revolution and even to Jesus Christ. Stowe chimed in by calling Brown a brave, good man who has done more than any other man yet for the honor of the American name. So she really gained a huge respect for him. A journalist of the time declared that Harriet Beecher Stowe had spread anti-slavery kindling far and wide, and John Brown came along and lit it with the torch of violence. And there's some substance to the claim. Certainly no other cultural figures polarized the nation to the degree that Stowe and Brown did. Small wonder that as the Union troops marched south during the Civil War, they sang the rhythmic words, John Brown's body lies moldering in the grave, but his soul is marching on. And it's understandable that just after the war, the author Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote a poem describing the ghosts of Uncle Tom and John Brown having marched through the war, spreading their anti-slavery influence everywhere, almost as ghosts. Indeed, Stowe's novel and Brown's actions taken together did more than anything else culturally to fuel the passions behind the war that ended the most egregious injustice in American history. And both Stowe and Brown continue to be presences in American culture right up to modern times. Brown remained a hero in the North for a while after the war, but then after the collapse of Reconstruction in 1876 and during the period that came after that, the period of segregation known as Jim Crow, he came to be seen as a mad fanatic. Only since the 60s, with the rise of civil rights, has his reputation been improving somewhat, a little bit. As for Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin went in many directions. It was published eventually in 80 different languages, and it was a strong progressive influence in many countries. 57 editions of the novel appeared in Russia, where it contributed to the emancipation of the serfs in 1861. It became Lenin's favorite novel in childhood. It was the first American novel published in China in Chinese, and it helped fuel anti-slavery revolutions in Chile and Cuba. Meanwhile, it continued to be popular in America. In 1905, the New York Times reported that the two best-selling books in America were The Bible and Uncle Tom's Cabin. Just as important as the novel were many versions of the play. By the 1890s, there were hundreds of acting troupes that fanned out across North America, putting on Uncle Tom's Cabin in every town, hamlet, and city. Many companies toured internationally, performing as far as away as India and Australia, and if you've seen the movie The King and I, Siam. Many versions of the play changed Stowe's hero, Uncle Tom, into a passive, obsequious old man. Now, this is not the way he is in the novel. In the novel, he's compassionate and loving and all that, but also very self-reliant. He's muscular. He's about around 40 years old with three kids. He saves a white girl from drowning, and he remains very, very tough in the face of the sadistic cruelty of Simon Legree, who hates him exactly because he is so brave and unflinching. But too often on stage, when the play was adapted to the taste of the Jim Crow era, this was in the 1880s, 90s, and all the way up into the 20th century, he was falsely portrayed as an obedient fool, totally lacking in the virile, muscular quality of Stowe's original character. And this is mainly why, to this day, the term Uncle Tom is used to describe a weak-kneed person who kowtows to others, a cringing sycophant or a spineless sellout. But we shouldn't forget that in all the versions, the play didn't abandon Stowe's central point about the wickedness of slavery. And for this reason, Uncle Tom's Cabin still remained threatening in the South. And in 1906, a series of laws were passed in the South called Uncle Tom's Laws, preventing the performance of the play down South. And one Southerner, Thomas Dixon saw a play, Uncle Tom play, in 1901. He was so outraged by it that he launched an all-out attack on the novel, which he considered a hateful work that had destroyed the good old plantation South. Dixon wrote bitterly, "Uncle Tom's Cabin caused the Civil War, killed 1 million men, desolated and ruined the South, and changed the history of the world for the worse." He responded to Uncle Tom's Cabin by writing pro-slavery novels that adopted the names of Stowe's characters, Shelby and Tom and this and that, George Harrison, but pointed them in the exact opposite direction by advocating the punitive lynching of black people, the supposedly justified punitive lynching of black people. And one of his bestsellers, The Klansman, was the basis of D.W. Griffith's landmark, adeptly made yet thematically abhorrent film, The Birth of a Nation, which made heroes out of the Ku Klux Klan, as in this scene here. The movie not only became the most popular film of the silent era, but also caused the real-life resurgence of the KKK. Then in the 1930s came the most popular movie of all time, Gone with the Wind, the romantic epic of the Old South based on the novel by the Atlanta author Margaret Mitchell, who said she wrote Gone with the Wind in part to counteract what she saw as the anti-Southern message of Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. Even as these pro-Southern films were supporting Jim Crow, Uncle Tom's Cabin was making its own mark in the film industry. No less than 9 silent films based on Stowe's novel appeared between 1909 and 1927. Like the novel, these films portrayed enslaved black people compassionately. For example, all the Uncle Tom films depict the lead character, Tom, as a dignified and sympathetic figure, and this is particularly true of the 1927 epic film, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which cost a then astounding $2 million to make and which featured a wonderful performance by James B. Lowe in the role of Uncle Tom. I was able to upload that recently on YouTube, so you can actually watch it. And it's a really well-done film for its era. And so there was a massive Hollywood duel going on, between pro-Tom and anti-Tom films. And a similar duel was occurring among American historians. One group, the so-called Dunning Group, named after the Columbia professor William Archibald Dunning, said that the Civil War, caused by fanatics like Harry Beecher Stowe and John Brown, resulted in Reconstruction, which these historians call a tragic time when newly emancipated blacks proved to be poor political leaders and predators who targeted white women. This is kind of the Dunning view of history. But there was another group of historians led by W.E.B. Du Bois who had a more accurate view, as we see it today, of the American past. For this group, the Civil War was emphatically a change for the better since it resulted in emancipation. From this vantage point, both Stowe and Brown were heroes. Du Bois wrote a laudatory biography of John Brown, and he said of Stowe, "Thus to a frail, overburdened Yankee woman, with a steadfast moral purpose, we Americans, black and white, owe gratitude for the freedom and union that exist in the United States of America." Now today, this more positive view of the Civil War and Reconstruction is widely accepted, and it's a good moment for us to recognize the importance of Harry Beecher Stowe in her novel. After all, during the Civil Rights era, it was those who acts of protest most closely resembled that of Uncle Tom. Stowe's Tom, the Tom of the novel, not the sheepish one of popular myth, that proved to be the most effective in promoting progress. Rosa Parks, the quiet woman who refused to give up her bus seat in Montgomery, didn't mind the Uncle Tom label, since she believed that great change could result from nonviolent moral protest. Another pacifist, Martin Luther King, though often called Uncle Tom by his militant opponents, also stuck to principled nonviolence and moved millions by telling America about his dream of a more egalitarian nation. These Uncle Tom-like figures proved to be among the most powerful forces for social change in America. It's time we do justice to Harry Beecher Stowe by correcting our understanding of Uncle Tom and the other great characters in the novel. A good place to begin is the source, Uncle Tom's Cabin itself. For those who want to read or reread the novel, I would like to recommend my new edition, a facsimile of the so-called Splendid Edition. It was really the second edition. It came out as a gift book in late 1852, and at the time cost an astounding amount of money. But I was able to produce a facsimile edition of it. And it has 117 marvelous illustrations, which are not caricatured whatsoever, by Hamet Billings, who is just a terrific illustrator. And he did Shakespeare and Hawthorne and everybody else, but he was just great. Read the novel itself, because it's really a wonderful read. Maybe some of you saw Nicholas Kristof's list of great works, classic works that you have to read. This was last summer, and he listed several books, Mark Twain and Emily Bronte and some Victor Hugo. Second on the list was Uncle Tom's Cabin. And he called it a profoundly moving read, a real tearjerker, a powerful and illuminating exploration of the human dimensions of slavery. And I love the way he wrote that. Kristof is right in saying that Uncle Tom's Cabin can be a tearjerker. When it first came out, a reviewer said, the human being who can read this book with dry eyes is commended to Barnum. That means Barnum's Museum, this museum of oddities and so forth. I have to admit that even though I had taught the novel in university classes for over 3 decades, I never shed a tear over it until I was actually writing my current book, Mightier Than the Sword. While working on the book, I saw for the first time just how much personal material and anguish Stowe endured as she wrote about slavery, and how positive, really, her novel's influence has been over time as a force for liberation in so many different ways. And it really made me kind of appreciate the novel a lot more than I had. And so I see really my book as kind of a companion to the novel. And I must say that writing this book made me appreciate not only the emotions and not only the impact, but also the artistry of the novel. The sharpness of her characterization is extraordinary, as is her narrative drive, her use of vernacular language, her subtly described scenes, which come alive in the mind like realistic pictures. In 1868, the novelist John W. DeForest coined the term the great American novel to describe Uncle Tom's Cabin. He found it greater than fiction by Hawthorne or by anybody else. Tolstoy called Stowe's novel an example of the very highest art on a level with Shakespeare. Now, I don't know if we can go that far, but certainly if you haven't read Uncle Tom's Cabin lately, give yourself a real treat and do so. Believe me, you'll be very happy you did. Thank you. Yes. Well, that was a movement called colonization, the idea that you could emancipate blacks or take free African-Americans in the North and send them back to Africa, called colonization. And the American Colonization Society was founded in 1817, became very, very popular. Lyman Beecher, her father, was a colonizationist. And at the end of Uncle Tom's Cabin, Stowe actually has George Harris thinking about going back to Africa and so forth. So that was a little bit controversial. However, we have to remember that Abraham Lincoln had this dream until the second year of the Civil War. He was a pretty ardent colonizationist. Andrew Jackson, Thomas Jefferson, Henry David Thoreau. There were lots and lots of people. Henry Clay, I mean, you could go on and on the number. Not much ever came of it. Only 15,000 or so African Americans were actually sent back to Africa. But it was a very, very popular idea. And at the time, might have contributed actually to the popularity of the novel. I don't know. It could have, because it was a slightly conservative ending in a time when it was a very, very popular idea. So, yeah. Well, until 1878, all the black characters were played by white people in blackface. But then Sam Lucas in 1878, who was a wonderful African-American performer, played Uncle Tom, and Harriet Beecher Stowe really, really praised this event. And she praised the Fisk family singers who sang African-American spirituals. And then Sam Lucas became the first African-American to assume a lead role in a film in 1914 in the Uncle Tom. Just before he died, he played Uncle Tom, and he did a wonderful job in the 1914 silent film. So Uncle Tom's Cabin had a very important effect in African-American performance. Yeah, it changed it, although I will say that even after that, a lot of them were in blackface. A lot of the people that performed were still in blackface. But it did change increasingly toward African-American involvement. Yeah, absolutely. Yes? I see. What was their influence? I think, you know, Henry really came out strongly against slavery before Harriet did. I would have to credit Henry as being, in a way, the pioneer within the family. I really would. He came out in 1847 very, very strongly in the Brooklyn pulpit and so forth. And I would really have to credit Henry Ward Beecher as being the first really ardent anti-slavery spokesman in the family. Yeah. But then, ultimately, her impact on a worldwide basis was stronger. Yeah, but... Yeah.
One playwright wrote
the play that was then disseminated. Well, a fellow named George Aiken, A-I-K-E-N, yeah, and actually that play was played down in the Village at the Metropolitan Playhouse last December, and they did a wonderful job there. But that was the most popular play. There were many other variations of the play. There's another play that was a little more pro-slavery. There were kind of pro-Southern versions of it as well by a guy named Howard. So, and then there are all kinds of variations on this play. But ultimately became just very, very, it became so popular. It was just incredibly popular. So much so that the audiences knew the lines just as well as the actors. You know, really, they would go, and they knew all the lines, though. Everybody in the audience knew everything. And yet they went back time after time after time to see this. So, yeah.
How long after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed did it take for slavery to die out?
Well, you know, the the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, that Emancipation Proclamation came out on January 1st, 1863. And then there was a constitutional amendment, the 13th, 14th, 15th, within the next, the Civil War ends, you know, in 1865. So the Emancipation Proclamation was just the first and then over of several things that happened that ended slavery.
It took quite a few years.
No, not at all, no. It was... It was, within a couple of years, slavery was gone. And the Civil War was over in 1865, so in early... Yeah, illegally. And a lot of people would argue that slavery never really died out totally in certain sections of the South, because you had a kind of de facto slavery during Reconstruction and even during Jim Crow and so forth. So there was kind of a second slavery, so to speak, even though it wasn't called slavery. So, yeah. Pardon me? Tenant farmers, right. Yeah, exactly. Yes? Well, during the 1960s, it was used as a weapon by militant reformers, and even by people like Muhammad Ali, then Cassius Clay, who would call his opponents, oh, he's just an Uncle Tom and everything. And it became circulating in popular culture back then during the 60s and kind of stuck, so to speak. But yeah, I mean, today, I mean, who was it who called Obama an Uncle Tom, and someone has called Condoleezza Rice an Uncle Tom and so forth? I mean, and Powell has been called an Uncle Tom. But, I mean, the phrase, in a way, sort of rings hollow a little bit today, it seems to me. It really does, even though it has a kind of circulation, or some people still use the term in that way. Yeah. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And so the phrase became a kind of weapon, a weapon of disparagement. People who just kind of sat back and sort of just nonviolent protests and so forth. There were a lot of reformers back in the 60s in particular who really wanted a more militant posture, much more militant posture, yeah. Well, yeah, it arose in 1867 and then spread, but then it was suppressed in the 1870s, mid-1870s. But then the movie that I showed, Birth of a Nation, 1915, really caused a resurgence, rediscovery, a real life of the Ku Klux Klan, and then became really, really powerful during the 1920s in particular, but also even in the decades after that. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it was incredible, this whole kind of cycle of events. Yeah.
For people who haven't read other works by Stowe, are there others that you recommend?
Well, she wrote 30 novels, about 30 novels. And if you can imagine doing that with six kids. She also endured a lot of personal setbacks and tragedies and everything like that. So, you know, she's pretty incredible. Minister's Wooing is wonderful. Dread is wonderful. Paganak People is just great. I mean, I just like Harriet Beecher Stowe so much that I, you know, and I teach these novels all the time. Old Town Folks is absolutely wonderful. Some of her short stories, you know, I love them. Yeah. Well, we're supposed to call it apocryphal. We know that she did have that meeting in November 1862 with Lincoln in the White House, and there's a lot of joking around. I wouldn't be surprised if he said it. However, the story didn't surface until 1896. She had met him in 1862, and her son said, well, Lincoln said this. So, you know, we're supposed to say it's apocryphal, to be sure. Yeah. Well, she would have made a lot of money, but she was quite poor before she wrote the novel, and she couldn't negotiate a very good contract. Her publisher said, I'll give you half the profits if you contribute to the advertising. She said, I can't afford it, so she took 10% instead of half the profits. And so she made $30,000, which was a lot of money back then, but still, you know. And she didn't, also, her book was ripped off. There was no copyright protection, international copyright, so it was just pirated left and right and sold in millions and millions. She didn't make a penny from a lot of the sales, and she didn't make a penny from any of the plays or any of the spin-offs or anything like that. So, but you know, she never really complained about that. Never really complained. Yes. It was in, I know in French, there were many editions in French, but I think French and then German, very quickly, French and German and Italian. There was even a Roman Catholic edition of the novel about the Immaculate Conception and all of that, which it's interesting, it was kind of changed. And in Russia, none of the plays had any reference to religion because particularly later on, even later on when during communism, so forth, because they didn't want any reference to religion. So it was changed quite.
Strong political message in the French verb, at least in the French readership.
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. It was very, very popular in France. Wow. It should be studied a lot, much more. The international repercussions. I mean, there has been one book on it, but there should be many, many more books on it. Many books on it. You know, it's a great topic for anybody who ever wants to take it up. Really, it's a wonderful, wonderful topic. Unfortunately, I can't read too many languages myself. But American Antiquarian Society just received a collection of all, virtually all the foreign translations. And it must be wonderful just to sit there and look at these books just as artifacts, if nothing else, you know. Yeah.
Did the
Egyptians
ever own slaves?
No, they never owned slaves, no.
They were back to...
Not that I know of, no. Unlike Walt Whitman, whose grandparents, they lived on Long Island, and it was, there was slavery in New York until 1828. Slavery was permitted in New York until 1828, so Walt Whitman's grandparents had slaves and so forth, but not to my knowledge, no. They came from a Puritan tradition that was really pretty anti-slavery. Yeah. Yes? I think she was trying to get us inside the domestic circle of these enslaved people. She was trying to get us right in the home and show that they were real human beings with real feelings, with wives, with kids, and all that. So, and there are these scenes early on in the cabin and so forth. So I think she really wanted to make the middle-class readers of her day feel that slaves were human beings. They weren't just beasts who could be whipped and sold and chained and just torn apart and sexually exploited and all of that. They're real human beings, you know. So, yes. She did, and the reason she did is that she believed she had sympathy for oppressed white people as well as oppressed black people and also for Native Americans and so forth. She wanted to make, and at several points in the novel, she stops and she says, this is part of a larger revolution, a larger issue of the working classes. Her husband probably read Karl Marx. He read German very, 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 very well. And Karl Marx's books were appearing. So there's kind of that element there, which is one reason why it appealed in Russia and in China as well, because it had this kind of subversive edge to it. It was really for the lowly, the oppressed. Yeah.
Did other siblings get into the movement?
Well, six of her brothers were clergymen, and Henry Ward Beecher was a leading anti-slavery minister, and all of them were in anti-slavery, all of them. And some of the sisters were, too. Isabella not only became a leading feminist, but she was also a leading abolitionist as well. She participated in the anti-slavery movement as well. So they were all reformers. They were all really thinking about society, and she wasn't really thinking too much about the money. That's why, you read her letters, letter after letter, she's not saying, oh, I'm making such a big hit, and everybody's reading my book. Isn't this great? She's thinking about enslaved people, and she's thinking about the effect that her book has on society. That's what really counted to her. So there's a certain genuineness that I think comes through when you read the novel, too. I really do. It's incredible that way. So, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very much. This is a book that actually can be read, I think, by, let's say, a 10th grader, an 11th grader. I happen to teach more advanced students at this point. But yeah, it can be read. A lot of children were read this novel aloud. And, you know, it can be understood by children as well as adults. And I think some of the greatest writing, like Poe's short stories, can be read by seventh grade. I used to teach seventh grade, and I used to teach Edgar Allan Poe. I really believe that this book can be apprehended by people of all ages. Anyway, thank you very much for having me.
So let me just note once again that Dr. Reynolds is available to sign copies of his book, and he'll, of course, be willing to chat with you as well. We'll ask him to be at the front of the building, so just come to the front. And thank you all for coming out tonight.